Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Rep. John Rep is a widely published poet, fiction writer, essayist, and book critic. His new book, Fat Jersey Blues, won the 2013 Akron Poetry Prize, chosen by David Kirby. His chapbook, entitled Music Over the Water, was published last year by Alice Green and Company. Since 1978, he has taught writing and literature at various colleges, universities, schools, and social service agencies. A native of southern New Jersey, he has lived for many years in northwestern Pennsylvania. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jan. How are you?
Good. It's so great to see you. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming. And so you're going to read from your new book.
I am indeed.
Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay,
go ahead. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Trucking flowers to the dump on a day like no other. Big Vic drove, Little Vic rode shotgun, chewing the stub of a dead stogie. The green pickup, hill of flowers from that day's funerals. Ronnie and I squatted behind the cab, shirtless kids in pith helmets. Best part of the job, floral wind, drying sweat, afternoon shade of the cab. Pre-dump stop at Scotty's so Big Vic could tilt the ritual half pint of vodka to the sky. On the day like no other, we ferried two bums earning a day's pay, Boss Bill a soft touch. They slowed down all we did and now sped up the best part, every second free of the dead still heat precious. One bum pressed his forehead to his knees. My God, we all stank, but they exceeded the reach of that word and all its synonyms. Dressed in a filthy suit and tie, the other bum worked Q-tips in and out his mouth, tossing bloody ones over the side as we rode. Then the monumental stench of the dump, us raking a few minutes, Q-tip doing a good job with the push broom at the end. Even then, I knew not to seek a lesson. Afternoon break, I poured the last of my high C into the red cup and drank it. This poem is for a good friend of mine, old friend of mine, Linda Lee Harper. It's called The Channel Deeper Than Anyone Has Ever Known It, Except for the Implacable Scavenger. When everyone reminds one of someone else, unthought till one sees bending for a dropped pack of gum, Jimmy from the painting crew, or Bruno bearing a pocketful of starry ganja soon to billow into the shady heat behind Unit 2, or Ingman wading through the playground scrum, clicking his beetle boots with the tacks on the heels, or Drum resplendent in the canoe drifting down the wading, or Joanne shoving the mooshu pork round the plate while Letty slugs Cuervo Gold and the fridge rattles so hard the sugar cookies slide off and Jean trips trying to catch them, or Danny leaping into the Valley Avenue briars for the last baseball, or Melvin huffing a munchkin pile of coke off his knuckle before lifting "You are my special angel" into the ether, or Dottie picking her fro before tucking into the meatloaf. One of the three Daves calls vegetarian Waterloo, or Carl frailing way down the old plank road with the fire roaring and the blizzard of whatever year that was piling snow past the ridgepole, or Billy slicing a backhand, or Judy whooping as the ball catches the line the way Billy's backhands always do, scooting flat and dead toward the fence. One should say thank you. Reread the wisdom books and Kierkegaard, take another run at Meister Eckhart and at long last fall into silence and reconsecrate oneself to what is without the moony bliss that phrase since the not quite post-Vietnam American 70s calls up in those of us who first whiffed clove cigarettes during the myriad blotto parties way back in the piney woods we mistook for Arcadia. Ah, should. Say grace, and one might do what one should till the time for might has gone. New ones one sees seem old as one life can hold. Doing doesn't go there, nor wanting, nor even the gratitude at which gratitude merely nods. This poem is, the title of this poem refers to an Indian writer, mystic, named called himself J. Krishnamurti, and the title is Krishnamurti. Remarkable in July 1975 to find Think on These Things on the religion shelf in the Landis Avenue bookshop, now a Payday Loans storefront. Autobiography of a yogi and Be Here Now, too. In the post-industrial way of things, Landis Avenue has vanished, except for the street signs, churches, and Wainwright Funeral Home. I'm sorry to say this is America, so the only bookstore in 50 miles sells multicolored Bibles, bad novels, and trinkets, not just tacky, but idolatrous. Paramahansa Yogananda could fly. He talked with Jesus. In great excitement, I told Kathy and Lois about his astral exploits, though each had taken Christ as her personal savior. Lois by far the more pious. Kathy doing our sociopathic boss on lunch break, saying, God knows my flesh is weak, as she dabbed each ear with perfume. Jesus had always awed and infuriated me, but no one knew. He seemed everyone's excitement or quiet friend. But a yogi who not only flew but chatted with God the Son? How could you not marvel? We manipulated royal manual typewriters. None of us fast or cowed enough for Walt, though I came closest. In the karmic way of things, that vast plant has long since vanished too. Dust to dust, pride goeth, lilies of the field. I found Krishnamurti dry. Better the drenched bhakti adoration Ram Dass spread like a Bosch banquet. Sitting in full lotus feels like flying, but the severe Krishnamurti wore business suits. He had Kafka eyes. Sitting in my red brocade armchair, I'd read a few pages at a time and try not to think in my ticky-tacky home on Cedarville Road.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Rep. He's reading from his new book, Fat Jersey Blues, which won the 2013 Akron Poetry Prize, chosen by David Kirby. John, you have some long lines in your
yes.
book, thick with details. Mm-hmm. And if I think I'm correct in saying that you've always sort of loved the long, thick lines. Can you talk about that, your propensity for that, and why choosing to stay with that?
Well, a couple ways to answer that. One is the poems in this book are, most of them are long lines, and I do love to work in that. It's not really a form or rhetoric. I mean, I have a lot of poems that are pretty skinny, but they just don't happen to have ended up in collections. But anyway, I'm not answering your question. Part of it is I just love the accumulation of detail. I have a good time trying to fit all this detail into a sentence that might, with long lines that might go on for five or six lines and make it all make sense and have a forward momentum and not bog down. And the last thing, and probably the most important thing, is sound is and always has been really important to me. And it's partly my reading, a lot to do with my reading. Poets, I mean, the obvious person would be, or writer would be Whitman. But the one who really set me off on long lines and some of the ways you handle them really well is C.K. Williams. He had a lot of big influence on me quite a long time ago, and continues to have an influence.
And didn't you also like Albert Goldbarth?
I love Albert Goldbarth, yeah. Yes. He writes so many books. I have practically a whole shelf full of Albert Goldbarth, yes. And I love his stuff.
Yeah, and you know, the sound and the rhythm of the lines, I mean, when you're reading, I could just hear things moving along, and I think it's great. Plus, then you come upon unexpected details, like, I mean, I love... I found Krishnamurti dry. I've never heard that before. I've never heard anyone say that. So
thanks.
but yeah, I love, yeah. I find it very, really difficult to write in long lines to sustain that. I mean, yeah. That's no easy thing. And you're really good at it. So,
thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. This poem is called Crystal Meth Under Her Choir Robe. No surprise. Bills to pay, pain to obliterate, a favor to a friend desperate for more time before facing facts, or a reason less beholden to one day at a time, or I don't know why, or there is no why, I just like getting high, or then Jesus spoke to me, blather. Nothing's enough. Not even the moments when her voice, any voice, my voice, vanishes into the voice, the hymn wrenches from the throats of the spiritual paupers up there, swaying in black satin. The God of the garden is the God of chemistry, too. A single sniff in a lifetime, proof enough. Nothing can slough errands or heartbreak so fast into the metaphysical ditch where all of it belongs. Weren't we made for better than the fall, if fall this is? We all see what the flood keeps doing. A little while dry, please. A little while with no chattering chimp between the ears and the wizard once more in Oz. This is my mind, not hers. She's a story I heard. I'm a story I can't stop hearing. A plastic tarp and a monsoon may be her future. A plush ride home to havoc. A vision that delivers her from want, deserving or not. I'm going to move now to a couple of elegies for my dad, who died going on 4 years ago. This first of those two poems, called Jumbo Pagano, might have work for you. And I have to say that again because that's also the first line. Jumbo Pagano might have work for you, said my father in two letters a year apart. But Jumbo Pagano never came through. So I packed eggs and cut grass and lifted things and set them down and drank Hawaiian punch and stuffed meatball subs down my throat and swallowed hot peppers whole and spoke pidgin Puerto Rican and ogled the girls and huffed hash and stripped my work shirt and rolled up my cuffs and sailed my pith helmet through the white air behind Unit 2, the ferocious sun cooking me. And my father kept putting the word out, saying, sorry for my grammar. Maybe the union, not Jumbo, said no. It'll work out. Keep at it. My only sorrow, a sorrow never to slacken, the lack of 1,000 letters in which he writes the why and wherefore of his luminous and infuriating self in a hand I'd know blind, a hand practiced in the vanished school on Grove Road and perfected in the 40 years of packing lists and bills of sale and loan settlements and purchase agreements that kept us dry in the deluge and cool in the heat and full of food. This is called the Ocean City poem. Leaning on a lamppost after we buried our father, I wear a fluttery smile. I could have bought the twitchy upturns at each mouth corner if Woolworth still sold them. I don't feel like a worm casing. I am the damp, aromatic, fecund thing itself, grown arms and hair and a belly pressing against a maroon shirt, and want nothing but to have been left behind the chill nightcrawler undulating on and on through the lightless soil. Jim's Lunch still sells crab cake sandwiches, still drapes a single leaf of iceberg lettuce over the patty and serves tartar sauce on the side, the little pleated cup chilled from its stay in the 1936 frigid air, behind the cash register with its steel crank and yellowed enamel grip and walnut veneer I hunger to kiss. I say to the withered waitress, a thing is a joy forever, and step into the air over High Street for just a moment, gravity reciting its timeless tale once more, but Jim's was Millville, and this is Ocean City. Not the Maryland obscenity, but the one that makes you buy your cherry vodka in Summers Point, Marmora, or the whitewashed cube on the first corner inside Strathmere. I is someone else, and always has been, thank God, or this would vaporize. The whitened, much thickened embodiment of cliche and authentic feeling who wears a smile because Chris wants a photograph, and where is what you do with a smile after Father has strode into the church of cliche and wordlessness. On a wall somewhere rests the photograph of the skiff from which he first fished. Behind the wizened eye laboring to smile lies the ramp up which Ken, Chris, and this body of mine will walk to breathe the surf and say nothing and buy fudge at the only shop on the boardwalk not closed for the season. Fudge has always been too sweet for me, one of the few blessings this mouth has always refused. I first breathed a girl's smoky hair at the top of that ramp. She loosened her hold on my hand, and we fell together. Nothing does justice to the music pier or the horseshoe crabs. Till the end of time, three men will drive to Dividing Creek and on to Reed's Beach and come to rest at the seawall in Fortescue. The bay will be calm, the tide out. They will stand in the windy sun and breathe salt without him. The Ocean City poem has no use here. Nothing does. There's a much shorter poem called Sand Road Stomp, Slight Return. Cold, hungry, no moon up there. Up there, no moon up there. Dance so you can fly, dance so you fly. Way over the pines, oh, high over the pines. Bury me here in the summertime, bury me here in the summertime. Roast a pig all night drowned in wine. Roast a pig and toast me sometime.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Rep, reading from his new book, Fat Jersey Blues. Wow, I love those Father poems.
Thank you.
They're really great.
Thank you.
Yeah. The ending of that one, where you say, he kept us dry in the deluge.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read those last couple lines?
Yeah, sure. Let me find it here.
They were so great.
Let's see here, Jan. I think it's page... Yes. Yeah, I'll read the... perfected in the 40 years of packing lists and bills of sale and loan settlements and purchase agreements that kept us dry in the deluge and cool in the heat and full of food.
That was nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, really nice. People can't see this, but on the cover of your book is a picture of your father as a small child, mm-hmm. and this very cool car. Do you know what car it is?
No, I don't. My guess is it's a Model A.
Okay.
Model A Ford, that's my guess.
So it's 20s, 30s?
No, this is 1931.
31,
on the cover,
okay.
Yeah.
It's a really cool cover.
Thank you, thanks. You should thank the designer, who's just wonderful. Young designer at the University of Akron Press.
Mm-hmm.
Has a great future in front of her.
Well, the choice to put that picture
mm-hmm.
on the cover and with your father there and these father poems, can you talk about that a little? Because that's kind of a big choice. I mean, it's a great, great cover. But
yeah, gosh, you asked these... clear and difficult questions. I don't, you know, it ever since I knew it existed a long time ago, I've always loved this photograph. And they were kind enough to ask for ideas for cover images and specifically photographs. So I sent them, I think, four photographs. And, you know, because I'd been writing, I mean, there are a few more elegies for my dad. Because I'd been writing those poems, you know, there's four of them in the book, and the poems are, you know, probably 9 out of 10 of the poems are set in southern New Jersey as I lived it. mean, I left 40 years ago almost, but so that accounts for the title. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Well, no,
it's just incredibly appropriate. They picked the one I was hoping they'd pick, so yeah. That was nice.
Yeah,
that was nice. All of them had him in it.
Oh, but, okay, I see.
But they picked the one I liked the most.
That's cool.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah.
Now you've been writing for many, many years.
Yes.
Can you talk about that at all, as in sustaining that work? And you live in Edinburgh, or?
No, I live in Erie. I teach at Edinburgh University. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can you talk about the challenges and the rewards of maybe not living in New York City or not living in this madness to write, but what happens?
Another good and hard question. let's see. I do my best and fail too many times to count to make writing a habit, a daily habit. What sustains it, I think, what sustains it more than anything else is reading. I've been, since I don't have a memory of not reading. I would read everything as a kid. I mean, when I got to read, and I mean, I can remember, you know, my dad taking us for the Sunday papers on Saturday night and to the newsstand, and I forget how old I was, but I started getting interested in almanacs. So he would buy me these huge almanacs, and I'd read these almanacs. And I read the cereal boxes, and we couldn't afford the Britannica, so we had the World Book Encyclopedia, and I'd read that. And go to the library once a week. My mom would take us to the library once a week. So reading has sustained it more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's reading writers that it's just such a joy to read, and it becomes more and more, it's an enjoyment. I mean, am I answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you're saying that.
It's practice. It's practice. And, yeah. And it's at a certain point, it becomes a discipline that's not where you're not whipping yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's a discipline because it's what you do. It's like practicing foul shots, you know, or mm-hmm. something. So
yeah, that's what I do. I do my foul shots in the morning and
exactly.
my writing in the afternoon.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I try to have some semblance of that sort of schedule, too.
Yeah. Well, no, but I think the relationship between reading and writing is, you know, it seems obvious, but, you know, something I have to tell my students about. And
yeah, and it's really, it's sad, not in the case that it's, you know, good for them like medicine's good for them, but they're missing so much if they don't. There's so much amazing stuff out there that
right.
you're missing if you're not reading.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have time for some more.
Okay. Now, let me read this. It's called The Maltese Falcon. The Maltese Falcon premiered the year Bob Dylan was born. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and my father worked the milk route with his brother, which required sleeping through trigonometry. It could have been the bread or egg root or even the tavern, which hadn't yet burned down. But everyone worked. That was the rule. And I knew no one who didn't till one grandfather left the sawmill at 76 and awed into his wing chair for 2 years to watch whatever the Philco, Heine, and Al bought him pulled in from Rhinelander. Three people remain who know how he thumbed tobacco into his black pipe and slipped his suspenders down before lighting up. All right, everyone didn't work. Sue me. At least kids under 12 in my generation didn't. And how lucky not to even have to think about hauling hot bricks to bed, or whether we'd survive what penicillin could now kill, or whether a raccoon would break into the outhouse, which always seemed to happen past midnight in January. Bob Dylan worked too, sweeping his father's appliance store. But how can you affix facts to someone who didn't become Bob Dylan till no one knows when, maybe not even Bob Dylan? 9, my father formed hamburger patties by the thousand and did 40 or 50 other things, now lost in time's Sahara, before waking at 3 6 days a week so Phil could rattle the panel van around town saying, "Hurry up, Johnny," though my father ran the milk or eggs or bread to the sleeping houses because Phil only slowed down, and I'd be out of luck, but that was my brother Phil. And what's high school next to that? This deserves a ballad and a nameless genius to sing it. By 1942, Bud had gone to the war, but not the Pacific, thank God, only England, but that was far enough and meant more work for everyone else. My never-ending work is to work to make this and everything else in our life's work true. By the power vested in me as the writer of this poem, I hereby treat all my blood kin to the Landis Theater premiere of The Maltese Falcon. In the damp heat, October has failed to break. They're decked out in seersucker and silk, delighted to shiver in air conditioning's miraculous chill. They fill the front row of the balcony, the boys' feet propped on the rail, the girls' ankles crossed on the floor. At the end, they stretch and yawn as Bogart winces at the stuff dreams are made of. Down T-Burner Road. Under the plane tree, baby came to me. Out of the green, so green, she ran to me. Wet in the rain, wet in the rain. She said, "Come inside, get warm. Come inside, get warm, baby." So I drank down brandy in the coffee, fire in the wine, and hot wind blowing through, fire in the wine, all night in the hot wind. My baby and me wet in the black, dark room. Had a fine time in the room there. Had a grand time rolling in the room there, where people in bad times hid and ran, through the rain and the dark a long way, through the rain and the dark a long way, where the sun peeked out maybe, under a plane tree in the sun maybe, under a plane tree in the sun maybe. I'll end with a short poem that's not in this book, something my son said when he was about 3 at the breakfast table. First line's that, here's the title. Happy we not dead. "Why you happy we not dead?" asks the oatmeal-caked philosopher at our breakfast table. At last, a permanent answer. Because I love eating and watching you eat.
That's great.
Thanks.
It's the poetry of John Rapp. Thanks so much for coming, John. You were great.
It's been a pleasure, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.